Last class, we finished up studying Ecclesiastes chapter 8, where we were looking at that man cannot prolong his life through justice, righteousness, or wickedness. And you know, we got looking at, you know, man wants to know the reason why. Man can focus intently and to seek the truth of everything under the sun, but it's not something that we're given to know. And we talk about how that recognition, it can save us a lot of time and effort knowing that it is one of those unanswerable questions. Before we begin, let's go through the review, some of the common questions we go through over and over again just to keep our mind on track. Bless you.
Thank you.
Ecclesiastes, what does Ecclesiastes mean? Yes, preacher. And what was the question of the book?
Is there a prophet under the sun?
Yes. What prophet is there under the sun? And what was our answer to that?
All is vanity.
Yeah, there is no prophet. All is vanity. And what was the focus of the book? The aspect of human life under consideration?
Life under the sun.
Yeah, life under the sun exclusively, solely. And we've seen multiple times, and we'll see again, what's the author's recommendation? How to live our lives?
Enjoy blessings, Mark.
Enjoy it. Yeah, we should enjoy our lives under the sun. So, chapter 9. It's the first section of this, or for most of it, I entitled it The Enduring the Inevitability of Death. Of course, that's something we all know about. And in the first few verses, it's the common fate of man, beginning in verse 1 through 6. For I considered all this in my heart, so that I could declare it all, that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God. People know neither love nor hatred by anything they see before them. All things come alike to all. One event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good, the clean and the unclean, to him who sacrifices and him who does not sacrifice. As is the good, so is the sinner. As he who fears an oath. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. He who takes an oath is he who fears an oath. This is an evil that is done under the sun, that one thing happens to all. Truly the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts while they live, and after that they go to the dead. But for him who is joined to all the living, there is hope. For a living dog is better than a dead lion. For the living know that they will die. For the dead know nothing, and they have no more reward. For the memory of them is forgotten. Also their love, their hatred, their envy have now perished. Nevermore shall they have a share in anything done under the sun. And there's a lot of material in this. There's six verses. But we see in the beginning there that, you know, we realize that there is one common fate of man, as it says in verse 1. All right, is it saying verse 1? Well, yeah, but in verse 1 it says that, you know, we're in the hands of God. The righteous and the good are in God's hands. However, man knows neither love or hatred from God. And that's how my translation gives it. People know neither love nor hatred by anything they see before them. And I took that as love or hatred from God. I know the American New American Translation says, man does not know whether it will be love or hatred, anything awaits him. As if, you know, we don't know our futures. We don't know if we're going to get love or hate on this earth. But I think when you look at the very next section in verse 2, I don't think that quite fits. Because, you know, we don't know what awaits us. And then it says right in the beginning of verse 2, here's what awaits us. All things come alike to all. There's no difference. Death awaits all of us. So I look at it as we neither man knows the two ends messing up. Man knows neither love or hatred from God, and as if there is a distinction. Does God make a distinction under the sun? Is there a distinction between the wicked and the evil under the sun that we see? If you look at these verses, what distinction would you find, if any?
All things come alike to all.
Mm. Yeah, all things come alike to all, so there is no distinction, is there? We all get death in verse 2. All things come alike to all. One event happens to the righteous and the wicked. To good, the clean, the unclean and the clean, to the human sacrifices, him who doesn't sacrifice. You know, we like to, you know, we spoke last time about the expectation. If you're good, God, you know, is going to bless us and we'll have long life. And the wicked, though, will, you know, they're not going to get the long life. Then we looked in verse 14 of chapter 8. Is that right? Yeah. There's a ban which occurs on the earth that there are just men to whom it happens according to the work of the wicked. Again, there are wicked men to whom it happens according to the work of the righteous. So it doesn't always work out that way. And so, you know, that expectation, that the distinction we believe would happen doesn't always occur. we're all subject to the same fate, whether good or wicked. So I took that as that God doesn't show us a distinction there as a love, or doesn't show hatred or love to us. Are you right?
Yeah.
Certain?
Yeah.
It's all right. We'll make sure you're careful, Jim. We love you. So, you know, one thing happens alike to all. There isn't a distinction. In this case, when we're talking about the death, you know, if you're, you know, righteous, there's no distinction made for you because you're righteous, because you're good, because you sacrifice. You know, still death comes to you. One event happens to all. The righteous and the wicked receive the same. And then, you know, like, and I've said, this is regardless of whether one seeks God's favor by obedience or not. And I think that's what we see here in verse 2 is, you know, the differentiation between the obedient and the unobedient. Those who are righteous, those who are wicked. Those who are the clean and the unclean. That we know that comes from, well, this is the covenant with Moses, that they strove to be clean versus the unclean. And they had sacrifices. And those who didn't sacrifice, that to be obedient, they had to make sacrifices. You know, the good versus the sinner. We also know, of course, that outside the context here, is, you know, that death happens to all. Here, specifically talking about seeking God's favor versus not. We know, you know, previously in chapter 2, verse 14 and 16, we saw that the wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Yet I myself perceive that the same event happens to them all. So I said in my heart, as it happens to the fool, it also happens to me, and why was I then more wise? For there is no more remembrance of the wise than of the fool forever. 16. So we know wisdom versus folly doesn't make a distinction. And we know prosperity in Job 21. Just a case in point. In Job 21, 22 through 26. Can anyone teach God knowledge, since he judges those on high? One dies in his full strength, being wholly at ease and secure. His pails are full of milk, and the marrow of his bones is moist. Another man dies in the bitterness of his soul, never having eaten with pleasure. They lie down alike in the dust, and worms cover them. We see here, you know, you take it as health versus illness, or, you know, just generally prosperity. the same happens to both, whether you're prosperous or not. There isn't a distinction made. We receive no distinction by obedience under the sun. Of course, we know outside of the context under the sun that there is a distinction, and that's what we strive to be, obedient. But for the moment, under the sun, it's the same to us both. You know, as I said, the rains come on the wicked and the righteous. And it says here that this is an evil. In verse 3, if this happens, this is an evil that is done under the sun. Of course, this evil is not morally reprehensible. This is a pain. This is a displeasure, discomfort to man that this happens, that this is the way it is. Says it's men are full of evil and madness is in their hearts. I think, again, we're not talking about, I guess I don't think it's talking about the evil that men devote themselves to evil because of this, but more of, you know, we're full of this discomfort, this displeasure, the pain of this, the inevitability of death, that, you know, we live our lives, this whole book is seeking what is profitable under the sun. We all live our lives doing things that we think are profitable. We look at all the extreme cases, people seeking after wealth to an extreme, people seeking after wisdom, for power, for pleasure, and we read here all of these things are vanity. But those are the things we pursue in our lives to some extent. And yet, it's all for naught, whether you realize it or you don't. Maybe eventually you will realize it. But yeah, it's madness to strive for all these things which will be lost. That are all vain, they're all futile. And so, what conclusion do we have? And 4? Wow. Sub-conclusion. Who's better off?
The living.
The living are better off than the dead. Mm-hmm. It's better to be alive than dead, and that's true for any state of the living. As it makes a comparison here, that for living dog is better than the dead lion. It's you know, to be alive is better than to be lowly, to be humble, and yet alive is better than be great, to be honored, and be not alive, to be dead. For the dead know nothing more here. Actually, I'm skipping ahead. That was the question. Why is this true? Why is it better to be dead? Wrong way. Why is it better to be alive than dead? Regardless of whatever state, whether, you know, bitterness of spirit, you know, as alive, than to be dead. Why is this true here, in this context?
The dead don't know anything. They can't experience any more life under the sun.
Yeah, they can't. The dead know nothing, it says. And what other points does it make? They're all sort of the same, but you can pull off different ways. There's no more memory of them after death.
Hope
the dead know nothing.
Hope for the living.
Yeah, there's the living have hope, and the dead don't. Ooh, what else? I mean, all the same thoughts. These are all correct, and
just elaborate.
Yeah, their love, hate, and zeal, all their emotions are gone. Well, and also it says that they have no more reward. What reward we have, the dead have, it's not available to them. No more reward. I also wanted to read Job, chapter 14. Job 14 and 21. Job's talking, you know, we know Job's going through tribulations and great difficulties, and wishing for death. And he says, "Oh, that you would hide me in the grave, that you conceal me until your wrath is past, that you would appoint me a set time and remember me." In verse 21, you know, in this death, he says, his sons come to honor, and he does not know it, though they are brought low, and he does not perceive it. And again, just this idea of, we see again this not knowing. Whatever happens to your sons, whether they're praised or whether they're brought low, if you're dead, you don't know it. And so, some people would take these scriptures as that the once dead, that's the end of it. You're completely unconscious. You're no longer alert. You're no longer, I guess you want to stop there. Just no, you're no longer conscious. You don't have any consciousness. You're not alert to anything. You're gone. So do we see these conclusions previously asserted, previously stated? Do they mean that? Do they lead to that conclusion? Or the fact that if there's not just a unconsciousness, that man ceases to exist after death? How would you reason against that from the context?
He's talking about under the sun. There's no more consciousness of what's under the sun. I'm not talking about being outside of that realm.
Yes.
And he tells us how to live in some of the other verses you discussed earlier in these here.
That's exactly right. You know that. So, I guess, we know that's the case. But what else would you show them, I guess, to say that, you know, to specifically point to them? I mean, certainly if you read it, you go, okay, yeah. But someone, evidently people are reading it and not coming to that same conclusion. What other evidence could you point to? I guess specifically, if it doesn't mean that, what do we think it means?
Michael, you're doing a good question here, because if the Jehovah's Witness comes to the door, this is the verse they'll use. You may run across somebody in the church that believes people are unconscious after death. They run across them down through the years, and this is the verse they'll use. Your question here is a very practical, pertinent question. How do you answer this verse? This is the key passage.
What more explanation would we give?
If you come on, of course, you've already talked about taking context, and not only context, throughout the book, for me, context. You keep reading, read a little bit ahead, read a little bit beyond, talking about verse 9, it is, I guess, where you go beyond, the contrast is made about enjoying life. Like under the sun, your wife, this is your reward. That's the kind of thing he's in view of the context that he's talking about. You can go, if you're going to do it, so you can go to the leaders. Harmony tells you there is life, there is a consciousness of it. You have life on this earth. So you can get out of the context, you get out of the harmony, there's a beautiful point that some way says, hey, nothing exists after this life. You're just either unconscious or you cease to exist.
Yeah, we know that's not the case.
Mike, you can also back up to the viewpoint under the sun. Go back to verse 15 in chapter 8. Kind of give you some more explanation of what the viewpoint under the sun. Verse 15, it says, talking about enjoying life. There is nothing good for a man under the sun except to eat and drink and be married. For this will stand by him in his toils throughout the days of his life, which God has given unto the sun. So, again, it's a span of human life, the viewpoint of it here on this earth.
Yeah, it's all, everything you're saying is correct. I mean, you know, we look at the context. We know throughout the context of all Ecclesiastes, we've seen, that's where we had the markings, under the sun. We've seen some 42 times throughout the book, under the sun is listed. And, you know, even this dead know nothing is sandwiched between two of them. In verse 3, the evil is done under the sun. And right in the end of verse 6, it says they're not going to share anything, nevermore will they have a share in anything done under the sun. We know this is specifically talking about under the sun. We know it's not that you cease to have their consciousness. This is just merely a lack of awareness. It's speaking about the dead know nothing. Just a lack of awareness. There's certain things even now, we don't know. I don't know anything about what's going on in Russia right now. Does it mean I'm not aware of what's going on in Texas at the moment? Or at least in this part of Texas? No, that's not the case, is it? I am just merely, I'm aware of this, but I'm not aware of that. It's beyond my range. It's beyond my scope. When you die, that which continues on in life here on Earth is beyond your scope. It doesn't mean you're completely unconscious. Just poof, you're gone. I had some other scriptures to look at, such as 2 Samuel 15, which is right along the lines of what I was just talking about. Awareness. Second Samuel 15:11 is when Absalom begins his plots, his scheming to rebel against his father David. And it said, "And with Absalom went 200 men invited from Jerusalem, and they went along innocently and did not know anything." And this is before he had these men gathered, before he's about to go proclaim himself king in Hebron. And it says these men didn't know anything. What's the context trying to say? These guys didn't know anything? They were infants? It's not the case, is it?
They didn't know the plot. What are you going to do?
Yeah, that's right. They didn't know the plot. They were unaware of the plot. So that they didn't. It's not that they didn't know anything at all. It's just that they didn't know anything about that particular scope of events. Even though they were close to it, they weren't. That was beyond their knowledge. Everything else was within their realm of knowledge. Also, when you look at, just in the past few chapters, in Ecclesiastes 6 and 12, we've seen this a couple times. In the end of Ecclesiastes 6 and 12, it says, "Who can tell a man what will happen after him under the sun?" And also in verse 14 of chapter 7, it says, "So that man can find out nothing that will come after him." Of course, this is clearly showing this limited range of knowledge. Man knew everything when he was here, but once he's gone, now he doesn't get to know what goes on under the sun. And it specifically says that. We don't get to know what comes on after us, under the sun. But it doesn't mean we don't get to know more of something else, even though I don't know what it is.
Be careful, because if I was arguing the other position, I would say the rich man still is aware of his brothers back on earth.
Does it say that specifically?
You ask Abraham to send somebody for his brothers back on earth.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. He knows what...
It was just one modification you want to say. It's not a matter. If I bring that up, you just say, that's true. But this book doesn't take into account that facet of human existence.
Yeah, correct.
That's the point. Just cut it off there. There's no,
you have to reason it out.
Existence like that discussed in Luke 16. I'm just not talking about that. So now cut that part off. You die what? You don't really think about it. I mean, that's it. You know nothing anymore.
Nothing that's going to help
you. So that can't be brought into the picture because he's shut the door on it.
Yeah.
And that's the point. And what proves too much proves nothing. We sometimes hear that. If you look at verse 5, he says they no longer have a reward. Okay, now you already pointed out that this is applicable to the person who worships as well as the one who don't, to the righteous as well as the wicked. So if a fellow wants to argue, this means that when people die, they absolutely have no consciousness. Then they also have absolutely no reward. Yeah. So the righteous have no reward.
And that's not the case.
And they'll argue that that's not the case. And yet, if you're going to apply it universally, take it that way all the way through the verse.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to go back to the reward bit. We know, from the context what this reward is talking about, correct? It's not talking about no reward of that which comes after life, but the reward... As Rocky pointed out in verse 15 of chapter 8, we're commended to be enjoyment. Correct, in verse 9. you know.
You got the qualifying phrase right there.
Yeah, that is your, well, mine says that is your portion in life. But we know when you look at Ecclesiastes 2, it also says this is your reward. Your reward is to have this enjoyment. This is the reward you lose when you pass on. Yeah, so we're not unconscious. We're just that's, and plus this is under the sun's scope. We're not dealing with anything outside that scope, whether we are aware or unaware after that. I don't think we had any further questions. Did anyone have any questions earlier? I went through that other part pretty fast about the love or hatred from God. Or did that all make sense? The distinction. God doesn't make a distinction. I assumed if someone had a question, they would have raised it, but I don't know. Maybe that's not the case. Everyone agreed, so it moved on. Anyway, so we know there's no distinction made between the righteous and the wicked. We know that all men are going to die, and that based on this context of just looking at everything under the sun, that's the end of it. You don't, there's nothing, there's no reward, there's no more knowledge. All your hate, your envy, your love, they all pass on. It's all gone. And so what do we have? And I think we already know, we already went to it. We have man knows that death is inevitable. We know that life is fleeting in vain, if we're reading this. And in view of this, preacher recommends what in verse 9? Actually, it's 7 through 9.
Mm-hmm.
Enjoy life. Mm-hmm. Right? And specific actions that are given here that constitute enjoying life.
Eating.
Food. Drink.
That's a good one. I like it.
Drinking,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. The thing I'm not interested in is modifying. It isn't just eating and drinking, it's in happiness. Mm-hmm. And you go down and drink your wine with a cheerful heart.
That's right. Eat your bread with joy.
Yeah.
Drink your wine with a merry heart. Enjoy your works, right? And we've looked previously, I think, in, I don't know, maybe it's going to go bad, maybe probably chapter 6 or chapter 5, about those who had the ability to, you know, they had great things to enjoy, but they didn't enjoy it, right? They didn't allow themselves to be merry with it, to have that enjoyment. But we need to take advantage of what we have. Rocky, do you have a question?
I think there's a good application, at least for me, in this lesson about eating bread and happiness, you know, and drinking your wine with a cheerful heart. You know, in this busy, busy world, for us that are working and keeping a tight schedule, got lots and lots of demands. I know sometimes when I sit down to eat, I just eat, you know, very, very quickly. And my wife will say, slow down, enjoy your food. And be amazed, just, you know, take time and, you know, slow down, enjoy your food, and, you know, thank God for it and enjoy it. And, you know, just a good lesson I know for me. Sometimes, you know, rush, rush, rush. And, passing life too fast and just slow down and enjoy
it. That is true.
Anyway, I've noticed this, he doesn't make a distinction of how much you have, how, you know, how poor or rich you may be. Just enjoy what you have. Doesn't, you know, see, if you focus on what you don't have, whatever, then you're not going to enjoy it. And that's, you know, we should do it. You know, be careful. I know I have to be careful of that because God gives us so much. Yeah.
And we've seen these mentioned before. What else in addition is mentioned here that we haven't seen before in this part of our enjoyment in life?
The shape mentions your wife. Is that?
Yeah, verse 9.
Is it? I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that's right, though. That's what I was looking for. That here, one of, you know, I think several, multiple times we've seen, you know, eat, drink, and be merry. That's the way to enjoy life. And here also, we have, you know, to enjoy our lives with our wives. Or, you know, in the case of you're a wife, then with your husband. You know, the companionship God gave us is to be enjoyed. And that's listed here, though. All the days of your life which you have. We know we don't have many, and they're going to be numbered. It's inevitable that we'll die, but as long as we have it, we need to enjoy it. We need to not take our companion for granted. What else is also is given here?
I was going to ask you about verse 8. Do you take the clothes as being literal, or is it, or part of the, like the next part, or not, like, not the oil be lacking on your head, like how you enjoy things? I wasn't sure about how to take that. Does that make sense?
I
enjoy your clothes, or is it saying your clothes be white?
I guess I'd say I take it, it's not specifically literal, but you know, it's. I think it's showing a point here of, you know, to the measure of how you enjoy your life. You know, we know, I think it's looking at that, yeah, the, that's what I was getting to next, is let your garments always be white and let your head lack no oil. Yeah. I don't go around pouring oil on my head, and I don't wear white clothes too often because they're hard to keep clean. But, I mean, that's true now as it is then. I think that shows how and what ways we can enjoy life. You know, we don't.
What this verse means is you never change your oil in your car.
Well, you switch to JW.
That's an extreme, but you know what that does, Michael, is show how a verse can be ripped out of a context. That's obviously far-fetched, but that does show how you can rip a verse out of a context and make it piece something. It doesn't even have anything to work with it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, this isn't going to be a literal thing, but I was saying, you know, that's the way, if you look at the way they had it, the oil, you know, helped them smell good. And wearing white clothes, as I began to wear white clothes, I know, like I said, now it's hard to keep white clothes clean now. And you look back then, how imaginably difficult it was to keep anything white. Those were something for special occasions, right? And he says, that's what you do. It's, I think it's the idea of, you know, living, I guess is
happy.
Yeah, I guess with the, like, fine living. If you're, you know, whatever extent you're capable of, you should be using it. You know, you don't take that white shirt up and it's too special. I'm never gonna use it, and you're never gonna enjoy it. And you know, if you have that bottle of oil that makes you smell nice, that makes you maybe makes you confident or whatever, if you, well, it's so special, it's gonna go on the shelf. I'm not gonna bring it down and use that today or tomorrow. And what's the possibility there? It's up on the shelf. You're not enjoying it, are you? And we're about to get to this beginning of verse 10 to the end of the chapter. The the next 10 through 12. Going to the uncertainty of life. I mean, we don't know. You know, life is uncertain. There's no guarantee of time. You stick it up never to be used, I'll enjoy it later. You may not ever get to enjoy it. So here it is. Take advantage of what you have to the fullest measure you have. You know, we need to, you know, it's our portion and our reward from God, as it has in Ecclesiastes 2:10. As Solomon himself said, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my reward from all my labor. And even in verse 9, it talks about, it says, this is your portion in life, in which the labor you've performed under the sun. We did enjoy life and all that we have, and not scrounge it, not, you know, hoard it away. And I think we've seen that in previous chapters, that same recommendation. So we come to 10 through 11. The uncertainty of life begins in 10. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. For there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you were going. I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to men of understanding, nor favor to men of skill. But time and chance happen to them all. For man also does not know his time. Like fish taken in a cruel net, like birds caught in a snare, the sons of men are snared in an evil time when it falls suddenly upon them. And then we see at the beginning of this, right after we're talking about, you know, the enjoyment of life, you enjoy things to the fullest that you're able. You see, whatever you find to do, recommends whatever you find to do, you need to do it with your mind. For, you know, when you pass on, there's no more of that. There's no more opportunity to perform that. There's no more knowledge, no more work or devices which to do.
Maybe a little word that was, after you're gone, then you don't have that desire to do things hardly or mightily or verbally. You don't have that. It's gone because you don't have that in you the zeal to do. It's not here. It's not there anymore.
Well,
right. Because you're not in the sun, you don't have that.
Well, you don't have the opportunity to do it.
Right.
It's not there to do it. I want to build some wood. If I'm gone,
right.
I don't have the wood to work on.
Yeah, right, exactly. You don't have that to do anymore.
The option.
Right.
Yeah. But it says here also that we're supposed to, you know, it recommends to us how, you know, take something and do it. And he recommends the way in which you do it. It says, do it mightily. I think through all verses. Yeah, and numeric, mine's the King James, and the New American, it says, do it with all your might. And I looked at that and saw mightily and took it to me also, you know, to do it heartily or fervently. I think as in Colossians 3:23. Colossians 3:23, and whatever you do, do it heartily, that's to the Lord and not to men. And so I get that this do it mightily is to do it heartily. And to better understand that, I went ahead and I looked these up to make things perfectly clear. And you know, to find these out according to how we think of these words, the thoughts that they mean to carry. And mightily, when you look up mightily, I think that which would that definition which applies is to be carried out forcefully or vigorously with energy. So that, you know, we see the so it's not like you just do it, I'll kind of maybe do it a little bit, but it's to apply yourself, all of your energy to it. you're gonna to devote a devotion or a focus upon it. Heartily, you look at heartily as I was getting to that. Completely devoted, determined, or with enthusiasm. And also gives that sense to without reserve or without hesitation. And fervently, look up fervently, it's exhibit great intensity or feeling. And I think these are all kind of intermingled, the same, you know, I thought, you know, to do things to your fullest, to do it mightily, yeah, you know, maybe you're not mighty, I'm not too mighty, but, you know, that's to do it with all the might you have, to do it with enthusiasm, with devotion, to give all your feeling to it. And I also like the definition of heartily is without reserve, without hesitation. If you're going to have hesitations, you're going to have reserves, you're not going to dedicate yourself fully to the task, right? You know, if like you start to build a house and you say, step back, I don't know if this is going to work. And you know, people who say that, are they really applying all of themselves to it? If you have doubts about the success, you might reserve energy, you might hold back some feeling. Also, get there. And of course, you know, these things that we're to do, you know, it's going to be something you desire. Is there going to be a limitation in that, in the context? Can we do anything we want? We just read, God doesn't make a distinction, so we can, between righteousness or wickedness, we can be wicked. Do wicked things, right? Is that what he's getting at? He's gonna, you know, this is talked about that the righteous are in God's hands. Even though God doesn't make a distinction on earth, we know there is a distinction. Certainly not saying that. Solomon had faith in God. He knows of the afterlife, even though it's not brought into context here. It's just those things which bring man enjoyment. It's not, of course, it's not promoting an unrestricted view of, you know, anything that's evil or sinful. Just anything within the realm that is good. We can take and we can choose, if we choose to do it, whatever it is, put ourselves to it. So why is this advice so wise? To act without hesitation or procrastination.
It's kind of like what Jim said, the opportunity may slip by and you won't be able to. You know, whether it's death or illness or something happening, you won't have the opportunity.
Yeah. And I think here in the context, it's specifically death. Of course, illness and can, you know, snatch away opportunity as well. But we see it when we read verse 11 and 12. It says, as it said, that man does not know his time. Like fish taking a cruel net, like birds caught in a snare. We are snared in evil time when it suddenly falls upon them. And in verse 10 as well, once you're in the grave, there you are. It's over. You don't get the chance anymore, do you? Whatever you wanted to do, too late. Death is... and I think we all know... Yeah, okay, we all know we can't do anything once we die. But the point here is, as it says in verse 12, is this it says suddenly, what's another word for suddenly? Sudden...
Unexpected?
Yeah, it's unexpected, exactly. Death is sudden and it's unexpected. We don't know the time of our deaths. Mm-hmm. We all know that we're going to die, but we don't know when it is, and so we assume it's far off. And that's not necessarily the case. There's no guarantees. There's no certainties. There's, better do it before it's too late. I wanted to look to Luke 17. It illustrates this same thought. Well, not the thought that we need to exercise that, but it shows the way we live our lives. Luke 17:27-29. Jesus is speaking about those in the time of Noah. They ate, they drank, they married wives. They were given in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark, and the flood came and destroyed them all. Likewise, as it was also in the days of Lot. They ate, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they built. But on the day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. We know they were going about their daily lives doing their own things when destruction came upon them suddenly. We know, of course, about the world which in Noah lived, and we know about Sodom, that theirs was a judgment by God due to their wickedness. But the same holds true of us. We go about our lives every day not knowing the time of our end, of our death. And so if we're going to choose to give, to have this enjoyment in life, we're going to choose to do something, we need to do it without waiting. With this in mind, does this mean we should prioritize our activities?
Good idea.
Yeah, it's a good idea, right? We don't know when our death's going to come about. We know we don't need to procrastinate whatever we do. Like, the next thing you want to do is prioritize what's important in your life, right? Of course, that falls outside of just, the prioritizing life falls outside of just this scope we're talking of under the sun. We know, if you're looking at just this context, whatever I want to do, I better do it. I want to build a house first, and then I'd rather have a house first than the table that goes in it. I prioritize and build one than the other. But we know as our priorities in life, we have, priorities, to our children, to our wives, and to our God. And we need to prioritize those, as needed. And of course, we still have to work and so forth, provide for ourselves so we have things to enjoy. But you always maintain that priorities in life due to the uncertainty of it.